Good morning. So last time we introduced pipelining and we talked about how we could add pipelining to this simple processor here, which only does add queue instructions. So we added these registers in between our stages. So previously our stages were just sort of a conceptual division of our processor. And now we're using those same stages and saying that we're going to do the work of the instruction one cycle at a time. So we're going to first fetch the instruction, then we're going to read its registers in the next cycle. Then in the following cycle, we're going to actually do the computation, in this case, adding two numbers together. And in the cycle after that, we'll actually write the values back into our register file. And by doing this in separate steps, we end up having things work out so that we get more efficiency. We end up having a case where now it's the case that we're executing more instructions per unit time because we've divided up our cycle into smaller pieces. And we talked about how the time was determined by our slowest instruction, so our slowest stage. And so that means that, you know, we're just going to be dependent on the slowest stage. To actually pull up the right slides here. So, first, let's briefly talk about how we're going to do this in HCL, and then we'll go back to our time. So, we have a naming convention that's going to be used in our book, and it's going to happen when we use HCL. And I'm going to talk about this a bit because it's very confusing. And a lot of people, you know, don't remember which is which, and because this is what you're going to end up using after the spring break when we have you start implementing pipelining in HCL. So we're going to give names to each of these registers, and we're going to declare each of these registers with something like register FD for fetch to decode. If you remember when we talked about HCL, we talked about register banks, how we have an input letter and an output letter. And in this case, the F is our input letter, the capital D is our output letter, and that means the wire coming into this register is going to be named with a lowercase f, and the wire coming out is going to be named with a capital D. And our convention, in our textbook's convention, is that we're going to always name register banks like this, where the input letter is named after the stage the input comes from, the output letter is named after the stage the output goes to. This means generally what our stage is going to be doing is it's going to be taking values named with a capital letter named after the stage, that's the values from the previous stage, and using them to compute outputs which are named with the lowercase letter of the previous stage, like this lowercase d underscore dest d here. And that's the work we'll do in each stage. And in HCL, the way that's going to look is that we're going to have something like D underscore dest D equals capital D underscore dest D. Taking the uppercase value, the output, into our stage and using it to compute the input to the next stage. So this is the convention we will use throughout. You don't have to actually implement things that way because, well, we're grading your processors ultimately on do they actually compute the instructions and do they do it in the appropriate number of cycles for a design. Presumably, you'll end up with some register which has these properties, and most of you will use these names because, well, you get to look at the textbook and say, look at the textbook's names, and they mostly correspond to what you're doing. So given that, let's turn our ADQ into actual HCL code. So we're going to need to declare register banks for all these registers. They are not built-in components, which are these registers. So we'll do something like have registers from fetch to code, and for the add instruction, we need those two register numbers to be passed through. And we need to specify their bit width. Register numbers are 4 bits, so we specify 4. And we also need to specify a default, because there's a question of what's going to happen when we're at cycle 0. What's in these values? And what this is saying is with those defaults, I'm specifying that the value here is reg none and reg none. It needs to have a value. We can't have a wire without a value. So we need to specify a value. So we're going to specify a value which doesn't do anything. So for the add processor, it doesn't really matter what those values are. It does matter. It doesn't matter what they are for the decode stage, but it will matter later on because this reg none here is what's going to end up over here as our DSD. It's what's going to end up over here as our DSD when we do the write back. And it's important that at least RB is reg none, because when we get finally to the write back of that phantom instruction, we didn't actually read anything from the instruction memory. It better be the case that we don't actually write a value to a register. So that's how we chose those defaults. Generally, our default values will be values that we want for a no-op instruction, because we want the initial thing the processor does in the stages when we haven't fed it a real instruction to be a no-op. So we do the same thing for our decode to execute here. So we have our DSD register, which again, we want to default to reg none because in our first cycle, we don't want the execute stage to be passing a real register number to write to. And we also have our values that we read from the register file. And notice that in our, that's what's happening. In our code here, we use our register file as usual, but we're not just directly computing on the result. Instead, we're just taking the result of the register file read and putting it in the pipeline register. So we set our source register number, which we got passed from the previous stage. We don't get it directly from the instruction anymore because we're not in the stage which accesses the instruction memory, and we use it to send it to the register file. The register file sets its output. We use that output, and we don't use it directly. We don't add it right away because that's the execute stage's job. Instead, we just pass it to the execute stage by setting little d underscore valet. So any questions on what's going on here, what this HCL code looks like? Yes? That is because there's a typo on the slide. So RA should be 12 to 16. This should be 8 to 12. Okay. And that is corrected on this slide. So great work, me. I'm not making my slides consistent. So you can compare the two codes. So previously, you might be using lots of things directly. But our general rule, and the way you should like think about whether you're doing pipelining stuff correctly, is that within each stage, the values you're using should be either one of the pipeline register signals that's prefixed with the letter of your stage, or signals for a component that's part of your stage. So in decode, it's fine to use these reg signals because the register file read operations is part of decode. But you should think, if you're using that during, say, fetch, that's a problem, because the register file read is not part of fetch. Similarly, we can use i10 bytes in our fetch stage because the instruction memory is part of the fetch stage. When we draw our box of where the fetch stage is, it includes the instruction memory. But if you're using that in some other stage, you're probably making a mistake, because that stage is not supposed to be using the instruction memory directly. It's supposed to get values from when the fetch happened a while ago. And so you can sanity check how your code works. And so we end up with these stages. So we have, this is all our pipeline registers. And the way I figured that out in this case is I have my picture with all the pipeline registers on it, and I could just write out all of them. I have to make up names for them. These, I think, are the most sensible names based on our textbook's convention, not necessarily the absolutely most sensible names. You could use other names if you like. And notice that I have to set default values for everything. And I chose my default values again so they correspond to doing a no-op. Even though we don't have a real no-op instruction, we still need a way of doing nothing at the beginning of our processor's execution. And so we'll talk about how do we do this for the whole processor. There's going to be a lot more pipeline registers, and we have to deal with executing different instructions. So we'll get to that in a bit. First, let's talk a bit more about the topic we ended with last time, which was timing. Which I believe, yeah. So, and we ended the last time mentioning that when we were talking about how much time we needed to execute instructions, we cared about the slowest stage. So, in general, when we're looking at our pipeline processor, you're going to look at all paths from something that has state to something that takes in state. So something where we read values to something where we write a value, and that write we know happens at the end of a clock cycle. And we carve out where we read values because something like this PC here, that's what changes at the beginning of a clock cycle. So once that change happens, we need our signal to go from here and go all the way around. And by the end of the clock cycle, we better have the right value here, where we're writing to the register file. We better have the right value here and here, where we're specifying where to write. We better have the right value here and here, because we might be writing to the data memory, so those signals need to be set up. And we better have the right value here, where we're deciding what PC we're going to use next cycle. So we can just start enumerating these paths. And if we're deciding on our clock time, we're just going to look through all of these paths, just systematically, just enumerate all of them, and figure out how much time each of them takes. All of them that go from something to something, from our state element to another state element. And we're just going to measure the amount of time that takes. And the way you do this, presumably, is that the person who gave you your ALU and your register file told you, it takes this amount of time from when you specify the register number to when you have an output. So you just add those together for all the possible paths. So we just enumerate all those paths, and that's how we figure out what our cycle time is going to be. And note that things happen in parallel. So for example, the way these paths work out, like in our when we talked about the timing for add queue being pipelined or not last time, we have this path where we compute the instruction length and add it to the PC. That is not actually what matters, because that's going to be shorter than when we have to actually read memory. And so that didn't end up mattering, because this red path here took longer than it. And in the processor, those two things happen in parallel. While we're adding to the PC, we're also going to be reading from the register file. and we just need the longest thing to complete, so it doesn't matter exactly how long it takes to add to the PC, as long as it's less than the amount of time it takes to read from the register file and the data member. And we can do the same procedure for, say, our simple add queue processor before we had pipelining. And again, we find the longest path. In this example, we're saying it's 500 picoseconds, and that's going to be our cycle time. And we're going to do the exact same procedure for our pipeline processor. So we have our pipelined add queue. We just, again, enumerate the paths, but we take a path from state to state. So we don't just have the PC to start and end at. We can start at the PC and go to any pipeline register. We can start at any pipeline register, go to any other pipeline register. And in addition, we can go to like writing to the data memory or writing to memory. Those are all places where we need to have something set up by the end of the clock cycle. So we look at all those possibilities. We have this list of paths, and we just take the longest one. And in this example, we're saying that it's the instruction memory that's slowest. And so we're saying that takes 210 picoseconds. And a notable detail that we kind of touched on last time, and the thing most students forget when they're trying to do this analysis, is that part of the time we need to take into account is the register delay. So this path needs to include our register delay when we're taking this amount of time. So presumably when I drew that blue line from our PC to these pipeline registers, I'm saying that it takes 210 picoseconds, including the amount of time it takes me to deal with the register changing after the beginning of the clock cycle and needing the value to be stable at the end. That should be included in there. And so if I just tell you the instruction memory takes 200 picoseconds, you need to also add in the register delay in order to figure out how long that path takes. So any questions about this notion of like computing our total cycle time? Yes?
Will register delay, if we're ever asked to calculate this, will register delay be given, or are we just going to
say? So the question is, if you're asked to calculate, will we give you register delay? If we expect you to get the answer, yes. Otherwise, you can't possibly figure it out. And typically, if we ask you to do this, we're going to tell you presumably what the person who gave you the instruction memory would tell you. Like, they tell you, here's my fancy instruction memory for you to use. It takes this amount of time. And we'd also tell you whoever the person who gave you the register to tell you, and they'd say, our registers take this amount of time. Yes?
The register delay for the first register or the final register?
So the question is, which register delays do we care about? So remember what happens on this path here is that what we want to happen is we have our rising edge of the clock and so on. And we have a little bit of time here and a little bit of time there, which is our register delay. And usually, it doesn't matter which register we count, so long as we only count one or like half of one and half of the other. Because conceptually, what you can think of as happening is that here, we're going to wait for, on this path here, we're going to wait for the PC output. And here, we're going to have to have some delay for the FD register input. And so, in total, we're spending one register delay amount of time. And it's a mix of the two. If you consider from rising edge to rising edge, you could also say we're really measuring the time here, and say you only count this register delay as equivalent. That makes sense? Other questions about this? Okay. So let's since we know about the timing and we know about doing the HCL in our simple IQ case, let's endeavor on turning our entire processor into this pipeline thing. Ultimately, it's what we're going to want to do. It's not very interesting to only execute adds. We want to have all our other instructions. And so what we're going to first do is we're going to say, where are our stages? And this is what we did with the add queue processor. And who remembers the first thing I noticed about when I added these boxes to our add queue processor that we need to deal with? So what we want to do is we want to just say, well, here's fetch to decode, here's decode to execute, here's execute to memory, here's memory to write back. Just draw some lines and add registers for everything which process. But we're not in a state where that actually works. So what's the problem? Yeah. Yeah. So in particular, we have these wires that skip stages. They go, when we draw our lines, they go from fetch to write back. And just like we did with the add queue processor, to make it so I can still just draw lines and add registers for everything which crosses, I'm going to make every signal go from one stage to the next if it's for the same instruction. So except for flow control, which is like, how do I set my PC, where obviously my signal better cross stage and go backwards, conceptually in stages, to like tell what to fetch next. We want them to go stage to stage, so we'll redraw things, like so. Just like we did with the add queue processor. And I've made a choice here. And that choice is that I have my muxes, which where I compute what register I'm actually writing to. I'm doing that in the decode stage. So I didn't have to do that. I can do that in the write back stage. For reasons we'll learn later, this will make implementing our pipeline processor easier. So once I've done that, I just take those lines and I put pipeline registers across them. In general, when I show pipeline registers, I'll probably do something like this rather than drawing each of the individual registers, but I really mean we have a set of registers for each wire. And like the diagrams we've shown you before, there's actually a lot of stuff not on this picture besides the individual registers, and that's all our control logic. So somehow all those muxes have to be set. There's a whole bunch of extra signals, and we'll talk about some of them that are going to do that, but I'm not drawing that on this picture. And in addition, for example, the data memory has some inputs about whether we read or write enable. That has to be set. I'm not showing those control signals. So any questions about this picture overall? So this is the processor you'll ultimately be building. And once you know how it's divided like this, basically your task is to write the individual stages after you've figured out what the pipeline registers are. So when you're writing the stages, like we showed you earlier, you're going to have this model where you're just reading the prior stages outputs and writing the inputs, or using components which are conceptually part of your stage. With the exception where you need to do something like a jump, obviously you want to tell the next fetch stage where that jump goes, not your decode stage, for example. Okay. So, this is about sort of the data path and things like that. We need to deal with control logic. So let's talk about control logic. I didn't draw that on that picture, so what is that going to look like? So we know that, for example, our data memory has a read and write enable signal. So how should we set that? So this is what we did in our sequential processor. Can I just keep it the way it is? So in our sequential processor, we got something from our instruction memory. In particular, we got what the book calls the ICode, the top 4 bits of the opcode. the first byte of the instruction, which tells us whether it's an MR move queue or an R move queue or a pop or an add. And based on that, we can figure out whether it's a read instruction or a write instruction and set our mem read bit and mem write bit signals in HCO. So can I just reuse this logic in my pipeline processor? Can I just have the same code? So I have somewhere in my HCL, this means I'm doing mem read bit equals, you know, I code equals equals MR move Q, then one, and so on. Can I just keep that code the way it is?
No, because you're going to be reading and writing for the wrong instruction.
Yeah, so no, because this I code, we have our fetch decode memory, where this is instruction one, then we had instruction two that was fetched after it, then three, then four, and this signal is for instruction four. If it's from the instruction memory. If this is, if we have our, in our HCL, if I code equals I 10 bytes, 4.8, like most of you have probably done in the existing HCL assignments. So if that's what you have, then that's instruction four on that list, and we are deciding what we're doing for instruction one, because that's the instruction whose turn it is to do the memory operation. And so our solution is that we're going to want to get the I code for instruction four. And we're going to follow this rule I just showed you, which is that we're going to read the prior stage's output when we need something. So we need to make the execute stage give us the I code. So even though that wasn't on my overall picture, it's just a control thing, it still involves the pipeline registers because we need to know the I code to send our control signals. So we're going to have a part of our pipeline registers is going to be that I code. And the execute stage, therefore, needs to know the I code of the instruction. So in this case, instruction two needs to know its I code. It can't get that from the instruction memory for the same reason, because instruction four is there. So it's going to have gotten it from when it was in the decode stage. So there's a whole set of pipeline registers. And ultimately, in the fetch stage, this means we pass the I code down every stage just so we could have it in the memory stage. This questions about this? So this means that where we started like this, we're going to end up doing something. This is the code I basically wrote down. Instead, we're going to set a pipeline register. So learn lowercase f is the output of the fetch stage into a pipeline register. So the fetch stage is going to set a pipeline register for the decode stage with the I code. And the decode stage is going to pass that from the output to the input of its pipeline registers to the execute stage, and so on. And that was not the right button. Okay. And here we are. Okay. Okay. Stage, and I forgot. There. And in the memory stage, we're going to have an appropriate pipeline register declared. So remember, capital M is the output of pipeline registers into the memory stage. So that's what it got from the execute stage, that signal from that register. And that's how we're actually going to make our decision. Okay. So any questions on what this code would do? Note that I'm missing a whole bunch of pipeline register declarations just for space reasons, but they're basically the same as our register FD, but for DE and EN. Yes?
Can you explain one more time what's wrong with doing like the initial thing that you had?
So the question is, what's wrong with this? So the problem is that like we're executing a program, which is like, say, I remove Q, well, let's just say M remove Q, then I remove Q. Let's say this is our program. So when M remove Q is in the memory stage, so that means that behind it, in the execute stage, is I remove Q. And behind it, in the decode stage, is the second I remove Q. And behind that, in the fetch stage, is the third I remove Q. And this is, so we have 4's PC is what's actually going to the instruction memory, which eventually goes to the registers. And what we're saying we're doing here is that we're stealing this output and sending it to our data memory rather than the execute memory outputs. And in fact, what's going to happen then is the data memory, you're going to have some values from that execute memory registers and some values from the instruction memory. And this is a common sort of mistake to make, even if you're aware of the problem, because you like copy-paste code and don't realize you didn't change everything you need to change. So it's a common mistake to make for that reason. And it's really weird to debug. Because what happens is, well, in this case, well, I remove Q is not going to read from the memory. Okay, that's a bit weird. But sometimes the instruction there does read from the memory, and you don't notice that this bug happens. And it's like kind of inconsistent. It's often pretty tricky to figure out this kind of bug, which is probably the bigger reason I'm going over this problem. So even if you know the problem, you'll often have it and not realize what's going on. You'll just get, why are you getting all these weird results? Like my address was computed correctly, but memory is not writing, you know, that sort of thing will happen when you make this mistake. Okay, so that's the general procedure for writing RHCL code. And something I didn't talk much about was how do we set the pipeline registers? What do we know? How do we know what they are? So we've just learned that, oh, we need the I code. And that's going to be a general rule. If you think about the processor you've been implementing so far, you have conditions on the I code everywhere. Like every single thing you set, you have I code equals something, then do something. So we always are going to pass the I code through all the stages, because we're going to have all sorts of places where we want that. But what other things go in our pipeline registers, and how do we figure that out? So one way to figure that out is to take advantage of how our book wrote down the instructions. So our book gives you this list of what happens in each stage, and you can use that to figure out what the pipeline registers need to be. So you start out by knowing, well, we're definitely having the I code, because all these things here we're doing based on what the current instruction is. And then we can just look at, well, what values do we define and where do we use them? So for example, in our fetch stage, we define RA and RB, and we get them from the instruction memory. And we can see we use them in decode, and we use RB in write back. And this means that we need to pass RA through everything from everything in between where it's first and last used, and RB the same way. So RB is used in writeback, and set in fetch. That means every pipeline register from fetch to writeback needs to have a copy of it. So that's the only way it's going to get there, just like when we use the I code signal in the memory stage to control the data memory. Everything in between needed a copy of the I code for it to pass from stage to stage to stage. So we just fill this out, and we can do this systematically for all our values. So you can look at val A here. So val A and val B are set in decode and used in execute, so that must mean they are in the decode to execute register bank. And if you do this process for all the instructions, you'll get a big list of things which go in. And this is how you figure out how to set up your pipeline registers in HCL. And note that you can do this all at once, like you could just go through all the instructions and write down the list of registers, or you can do this incrementally. You can say, I'm gonna add the add queue instruction. So first I have my pipeline registers with just iCode in them. I'm gonna figure out what I need to add by going through this process. And then let's say you add and remove queue, you get this pit, they get this list of operations for and remove queue, and do the same process and just do it one by one. Either way is fine with us. We think it's usually easier to go instruction by instruction so you don't have lots of do nothing code in your file, but whatever you feel more comfortable with. So something we're gonna do, which doesn't show up in this picture yet, is that we're going to, we're gonna rename one of these signals. So we have val e here, and we have this rb that we're using to write back that we passed all the way through. So we're gonna rename that rb in a weird way. And what we're gonna do is we're gonna set it a thing called desti to rb in the decode stage. And conceptually, if you remember my picture from earlier, this represents having these muxes up here in the decode stage. We don't need to do that. I could just pass rb all the way through, but it's going to make it a lot easier to implement some things we're going to need to do later to handle some special cases that arise from pipelining. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to have rename the destination signal into the special signal and compute that into code, even though I could just pass RB all the way through and figure everything out and write back. And part of the reason for this is if we look at something like push, we do the registers here. Well, we see, okay, we read RA, which I didn't write down. So we get that from the instruction, have to pass it through. We set val A and val B, and in fact, we need val A in the memory stage. So that must mean we're passing all the way from decode to execute and execute to memory. And we also pass val E all the way through from execute to write back. And we have this weird special case, if you remember, for push, where we set RSP, read from RSP, and set RSP. So we could just handle that based on the iCode. That's enough information to do that. To make things simpler, we're going to do all that stuff in the decode stage. So in the decode stage, we're just going to set desti to RSP to handle this. And now we're going to have more similar code. This is part of how it's going to make our implementation easier, but there's a bigger reason we'll get to later today why we're doing this, where it's going to make our implementation easier. There's going to be reasons we're going to want to know, hey, what register are you going to be writing to? And so we're going to track that information by computing it in the decode stage. So any questions about what I did here? And this general procedure for figuring out what pipeline registers we need. Okay. So I've talked about, you know, everything we want to know about the normal case for implementing our processor. But there's some things which still don't work very well. I'm gonna start with the simplest one, something which is a problem just with our add processor. So here are two instructions, add R8, R9, add R9, R8. Let's say R8 is 800, R9 is 900. So we add R8 and R9, so we get 800 and 900. In cycle 2 for our first instruction, and we get 1700, and you know, a cycle later we write that 1700 to register 9. And you know, while we're doing that, this addition here, so during cycle 2 we're adding 800 and 900, at the same time we are going to be reading register 9 and register 8. And the value we reads are 900 and 800. Because that's what's in the registers at that time. But you say, wait, that R8, R9, that should have already set R9 to 1700. Because that's what happened in our single cycle processor, and as an assembly programmer, you certainly should expect that. You don't think that I'm going to read an old value after just setting it. But this is what our processor does because we read the value from the register before we actually get a chance to write it, to write back from a previous instruction. And my previous examples with AddQ conveniently didn't have us accessing the same register we just used right away. So we have this wrong value that we just read. So this issue is known as a data hazard. And a hazard is any case where, because of some dependency, we end up computing the wrong value with our natural pipeline implementation. A data hazard is where it's a data dependency, where there's some data that we get an old version of. And what's happening here is in our pipeline implementation, we read R8 and R9. For instruction 1, we read R9 and R8. For instruction 2, then we write R9, then we write R8. That's what our implementation naturally does. But if we think about the Y86 specification, if you wrote down what each instruction does, that specification would tell you, we read R8 and R9, then we write R9, then we read R9 and R8, then we write R8. And so we're getting in trouble for doing things in the wrong order. And usually this doesn't matter. If we were reading registers that weren't ones we were writing, for example, we'd have no problem. It's only because these two instructions interfere. And this is something which happens with our pipeline implementation. And our hope is that we have some way of solving this. Obviously, we want to take advantage of the increased speed we're getting from pipelining from having a shorter cycle time. But, we still want to execute, programs with lots of add instructions and have this work. So there's several different solutions we're going to talk about. And I'm going to start with the simplest one for hardware designers, the absolute simplest solution to this problem. And that's to make it the compiler's job, to change your ISA. So what we can say is, our add instruction, that ISA specification was wrong. What an add instruction does is it reads two registers, adds them together, and then two instructions later, it writes their value. Just change your ISA specification to do that. So this is really nice as a hardware designer. We can implement this really conveniently. And this means that if you're a compiler writer, you're going to just add some nums to deal with that. Or maybe if you're smarter, you'll put some unrelated work in those nums. So usually, this is considered bad. People don't like it when ISAs have little catches like this. But this doesn't mean that there hasn't been ISAs which do this. This is a real thing some instruction sets have done. They've decided, the natural way of doing this has some data hazard. We don't want to have the hardware deal with it. We're just going to document when things get read and written, and we're going to tell the compiler and assembly writers, you can deal with it. So some real instruction sets do this. For example, MIPS version 1 had some things which work like this, like it's their multiply instruction, have this sort of property. But usually it's considered not acceptable. But this gives us an idea of what is the simplest hardware solution, which is that, things would have worked correctly if we only had a couple nops here. And we can do that ourselves. We can just have the hardware do that for us. The hardware should detect, something's going to be wrong here if I just keep going, and pretend it just read a nop from the instruction memory instead of what it actually read. And then once the conflict is gone, the hardware can go back to executing instructions as usual. So this is known as stalling. And this means we're going to add two things to our hardware. So we're sometimes going to need to keep the PC the same. So while we're pretending that we're adding not from the instruction memory, we want to remember where we were while we were doing that And so when we're done adding nops, we can go back to what the instruction we're at. So in this case, you know, we're pretending we write a nop from the instruction memory, but we still want to remember that PC is the address of add R9, R8. And we also, of course, need that logic to insert the nops. And because the way our processor works is in each stage, we look at the values from the pipeline registers to know what to do. That logic is just going to be, we're going to change the values we put in the pipeline register to be, instead of the values for adding R9 and R8, to be the values for a nop. In our add queue processor, if you remember how we initialize the pipeline registers, this is regnon. So we're just going to say that this is add regnon regnon, because that's going to make us do nothing when that goes down the pipeline. So the decode state is going to read its pipeline registers, and instead of seeing adding R9 and R8, it's going to see add register 15, register 15, and that's going to end up having no effect, even when it gets to write back, because it's going to write to register 15, which is special, means do nothing. And so with the R resolution, this is what we end up with. That we have some nops that we inserted. So at this point, I have stars here because something, you know, I'm not saying exactly what's in the PC. There's different ways of implementing it. But basically, at this point, we write R8 and R9, and we just don't keep going while we're waiting for it to be safe to go on to the next instruction. And instead, we put in our fetch to the code registers this register none value, which means that we end up writing back to register none, so nothing happens. And by delaying like this, it ends up that when we finally do fetch in the instruction at address 2, so we tried fetching it here, and we realized, wait a moment, no good, and we put the nops in our pipeline registers. We did it again and said, still no good, put nops in our pipeline registers. We finally got here and fetched it. We ended up putting R9 and R8 in our pipeline registers. And therefore, by the time we actually read, you know, during this cycle, we actually read 1700. And fortunately, we just wrote it at the end of the cycle. So just after we wrote 1700, by inserting these two nops, we end up reading 1700 and not the old value. So we compute 2500 and not the wrong answer, 1700. So does this idea make sense? And so this is the simplest way of dealing with our data hazards, and generally the simplest way of dealing with this type of problem. So usually, the pipeline will just naturally do the right thing. But when we have related instructions like this, we're going to have to implement some extra logic. This is the simplest thing to do, at least conceptually simplest. We're going to talk about some other solutions for hazards later because, well, there's, you know, it turns out that this isn't quite good enough for what we want to do. But let's look at what this looks like from another perspective. So another way I can draw what's going on is rather than look at the values of the pipeline registers, I can ask what instruction is running in each stage. And you can think of the stalling as being we keep the add and fetch until it's ready to go. And anytime we don't have something to do, there's a nop, and we're going to call that those inserted nops bubbles or pipeline bubbles, kind of empty space in our pipeline. So we're going to call them bubbles, and that just means a nop we inserted to handle a hazard. And note that we can look at this, implement this multiple ways. So another thing we could have done, which is not what the pipeline register values I showed you did, is that we could have said, I'm going to let this add instruction get to the decode stage, and then I'm going to stop it. And I'm going to stop everything behind it. And that just means that we're holding the values in the fetch to the code registers here to be the same and not advancing the PC. So these both achieve the same effect, and there might be a reason we do this. For example, we might not decide to compare register numbers to figure out is something bad happening until we get to the decode stage. And they achieve the same effect, and you can do either in cases where you have to handle a hazard. And so that gives us something like this, where we stall two stages instead of one. Any questions about this? Okay. So now that we know about stalling and data hazards, let's go through a simple exercise here. So I have my add queue processor, I have a bunch of instructions, and there are data hazards here. If I just do the natural thing, I'll compute the wrong values like I did before, I'll read old values before the new value, the current value has been written because of my pipeline stages. So figure out how many stalls we need to do. And to figure out problems of this sort, I recommend making a diagram similar to this one. Like figure out during each cycle what instruction is where and figure out how instructions advance. Do something like this. You can draw it in other ways, but that's what I recommend figuring out so you know what's going on. Do that, check your answer with your neighbor. I recommend paper, obviously, based on saying that too, and not just trying to think of it in your head, because I would probably get the wrong answer if I just try to look at this and get the answer. Okay, who has an answer they're kind of confident in? Couple people. Anyone want to volunteer to explain what they think the answer is? No? Okay. So, as I said, the way I figure it out is by making something like this. I'm going to draw this in a more compact way, and I'm going to talk about the format, because I'm going to show this a lot. We're often going to want to know what instructions in which cycle. So I'm going to draw this horizontally. So I'm going to have a picture where I have cycle 0, cycle 1, cycle 2. So this is time. And I have instruction 1, instruction 2, and so on. And I'm going to write down the letter of the stage. So F for fetch, D for decode, E for execute, W for write back. So our normal execution would look like this. And this is saying that we execute instruction 1's fetch, and then we execute instruction 1 in decode while fetching instruction 2. Then we do the execute part of instruction 1 while doing the decode part of instruction 2, and so on. Any questions about this sort of way of writing down what happens at what time? Okay. So given that, here's how I figure out the solution to this. So ordinarily, we just want to do this thing where we fetch, decode, execute, write back, fetch, decode, execute, write back, where we fetch one instruction right after the other with no delays. And I know that we have a dependency here. We write our 9 here and read it here. And we also write our 11 here and read it here. And in order to figure out whether we've solved our hazards, I'm going to draw where we write the value and where we read the value. And so in this case, I write the value at the end of the write back stage. And I need to read the value at the beginning of the decode stage, during the decode stage. So it needs to be ready during the decode stage. And that means in order to have this add instruction here, where we add our 9 and our 8, line up correctly, I needed to add a cycle of stalling, that red X. Like, if I was just doing the natural thing, I'd fetch it right after add our 10, our 11, but I couldn't do that and have the read the value we wrote at the end of the write back stage of our first instruction. And after I added that cycle of stalling, it made this next write, where we wrote our 11 at the end of cycle 4 and needed to read it during cycle 5, it made that line up. So yes, we needed to stall for that to happen, but this one instance of stalling solved both of the hazards. And this is part of the reason why I recommend making diagrams like this, because a natural thing you might do is you might say, well, I can just look at each hazard and count them separately. That doesn't work, because when you add stalling, that can resolve multiple hazards. So any questions about this and how I figured it out? All right, do that. Okay, so talked about hazards and stalling. And this gets us to something where we have to figure out, well, is pipelining still worth it? So here, let's say, I implement my pipelining and I have these hazards and I need to do some stalling for them. Let's say I measure for some program that I care about, some program I think is a normal program like the normal things I run in my system. I say 1% of them stall for 4 cycles, 2% stall for 3, 10% stall for 2, and 15% stall for 1. And I'm saying exactly 1, exactly 2, exactly 3, and you can assume exactly 4, so you don't have to worry about these being overlapping sets. I'm saying that the 15% that stall for 1 and the 10% that stall for 2 are separate sets. I'm not saying that 10% including the ones that stall for 1. So how many cycles per instruction do we have on average? So if I look at some random point in this program over time, what's the average number of cycles I take to execute each instruction? So cube that and check with your neighbor. who has an answer they can describe? No one? Who's not done? Also no one. Okay, so we'll just do it. So what I did is I say, well, every instruction takes one cycle to start with. This is throughput-wise. So remember, we're not measuring the latency, we're measuring how often instructions complete. So most of the time, we complete one instruction a cycle, but 15% of the time, we need an extra cycle between instructions, and 10% of the time, we need two extra cycles between instructions, and 2% of the time, we need three, and 1% of the time, we need four. You could also have computed this as 15% of the time, we take two cycles between instructions, and 10% of the time we take three, and 1 minus 15% minus 10% minus 0.02% minus 2% minus 1% of the time we take exactly one. You could have computed it that way too. Where, you know, in the first way I'm saying how much extra time do we have between instructions, and in the second way I'm saying how long is it between instructions, you know, as a weighted average. Yes?
Where is the one?
The one is every, as a base, everything takes one cycle. Because we still do instruction each cycle without, when there's no stall. And then we're saying the stalling adds this extra factor. So we get that it's 1.45 cycles in instruction. So if you were measuring cycles, of course it's slower than our single cycle processor. Like pipelining, the idea is to decrease the cycle time, not decrease the number of cycles. In fact, we expect to take a lot more cycles. So what we actually care about is how long does it take to execute a typical program? So let's say originally, before we added pipelining, our cycle time was 1200 picoseconds, and now it's 300. So if we have a five-stage pipeline, we got a fourth the cycle time, so we had some imperfect division, and this would be sort of the typical thing we'd expect. So given that, how much better is our instruction throughput actually going to be? How many times faster do I expect my programs to run is what this says. Because remember, when we care about how fast does a program run, it's how long does it take to do a whole lot of instructions. What's the rate per instruction, basically? So anyone? What should we compute to do this? Yeah.
Cycle time is 4 times faster, but we have to do slightly more cycles per instruction, so that we would just do 4 divided by 1.45.
I think that produces the right answer. That sounds like a good way of reasoning about it. Yeah, so that's one way you could compute it, is you could say we have 4x faster cycles divided by 1.45 cycles, more 1.45 times more cycles in instruction, basically, and you get 2.76.
I got 3.2. So.
4 divided by 1.45.
Oh, kept it wrong.
Okay. Yeah, I did the calculation just to make sure. Yeah, so it actually does work. So that is one way which works. Way I did it on this slide is I just computed the number of picoseconds per an instruction on average. So with 1.45 cycles an instruction, we average about 435 picoseconds per instruction with our pipeline processor versus our unpipeline one, where we did every instruction in a single cycle, we did 1,200. And if you take the ratio, it's 2.76 times faster. So note that by doing all this stalling, we've lost a lot versus sort of the ideal. So this is another way in which we have these diminishing returns from pipelining. Once we handle the hazards that happen, yes, we still have a lot of benefit as long as we're not stalling all the time, but we'll often have these big losses where even though a majority of instructions don't stall, you know, we end up losing a lot of that performance gain. Still usually ends up being worthwhile, but it's a big cost. So any questions about what's happening here? Okay. So that's pipeline improvement. So we talked about data hazards and our simple solution for them. There's one kind of another kind of hazard that we need to think about, and that's not with register values being wrong, and that's with control logic. So for example, I do an add, then I do a jump, a conditional jump. And well, I have my condition codes here, but I need the condition codes that will be set by the add. I need whatever to know what R8 plus R9 is, and if I don't know that, what do I set my PC to? I can't tell yet. So this is called a control hazard. So a data hazard is where we know what instructions to run, but we don't know what data to do the computation on. We don't have typically register values that, you know, that we want. They just aren't available yet. A control hazard, we don't even know what instruction we want to run because we haven't computed the information we need to figure that out yet. So what we're going to do, just like a data hazard, is we're going to insert nops. Is that we're going to, you know, we're going to say, oh, that's a jump instruction. I don't know what to do yet. I'm going to stay there until I can figure out what to do, which means I waited for the add to actually set the condition codes that I need to read. So the most straightforward thing to do is we wait for some number of cycles, and then we actually use our condition codes. And then we actually jump. So what this will typically look like from that other perspective where I'm showing you what instructions in each cycle is that we'll let our instruction that sets the condition codes go down the pipeline. And we're going to have this convention. We could say that the jump's computation that uses the condition codes happens in fetch, but we're going to say that everything that does things with condition codes is going to happen in execute. This is a design choice our textbook makes. You could implement something else, but that's what we're going to do. We're going to say that we do it in execute, which means that what we're going to do is not going to stall the jump instruction itself, but we're going to stall waiting for the jump instruction to complete. So we're going to let the jump instruction go down the pipeline, and it's going to compute where we're going in execute. And once we get the answer from execute, once that's done, then we'll have the actual next PC to use. So it goes down the pipeline, and by the time it gets to memory, it doesn't have any more work to do. But it's going to compute the condition code values in execute, which is the right time to do it because that's exactly just after the condition codes have been set correctly in the worst case. Like, it could have been that there's an earlier like add instruction and like we had an I remove above it, which shouldn't change the condition codes, but we're going to plan for this worst case where we set the condition codes, then do a conditional jump. And based on that, it's going to send information about what instruction to run next. So this is a case where, because we're communicating between two instructions, we're going to violate our rule about each stage passes information just to the next stage. Here, we're deliberately going to pass something to fetch from execute. And that's fine because we're passing information conceptually from the instruction that's in memory, the memory stage, the instruction that's in the fetch stage. Okay. So any questions about this way of handling conditional jumps? Yeah?
So you'll basically introduce two ways of implementing this stall, right?
So two ways in what sense?
And we always add the stall after the jump?
So we're going to do something which is a bit more clever than adding the stall, but our textbook's design is that we only use condition codes from the execute stage. So they're going to do this. And you can think of that the same way as like we only read registers from the decode stage. Same idea. This is a design decision, and we're going to follow that convention to make things work out. We could not do that, but you have to worry about lots of other cases if you don't follow that convention. Most notably, you have to worry about, am I reading the right version of the condition codes? Like, is it from the right add instruction? Is it not from an instruction later on in the program? You want to make sure that sort of thing doesn't happen. And always setting and reading them in execute is a way to avoid that. So note that when we had our data hazard, we had it because we read and decode and write and write back. And those are separated in time. If we read and decode and wrote and decode, we couldn't have a control hazard with the register values. And this is how we avoid data hazards with the condition codes, is by always manipulating them in execute. So this is the most straightforward control hazard. We have an if-then, and we don't compute the if part early enough for our dump instruction. There's another very important case where we have this sort of hazard, and that's with return. So if you remember how return works, we're going to be implementing it for homework, so hopefully you'll look it up. It reads memory to figure out where to go for the PC. And we, by convention, just read memory in the memory stage. So we're going to have to wait until we get to the memory stage to figure out what the next PC should be. So it's going to be that we're going to have the return instruction advance to the memory stage, and then we're going to send its value back to fetch. And you might say, well, we aren't always using the data memory. Can't we do this earlier? In the worst case, no, because maybe we have a call just before the return, or like a push or a memory write. So in general, like, we have to at least be able to do this, because it could be the case that we don't have the value in memory until just before the return would get to the memory stage. And while we're waiting for the return to advance down the pipeline to go to the code and execute the memory, we're going to have stalling. We're not going to know what to fetch, so we're just going to insert nops going down the pipeline. So any questions about this stall? Yeah.
Where would the nops go?
So the nops are these nothings. So while the return is in decode, execute, or memory, the decode stage is getting nops instead of whatever was coming from the instruction memory. And this is because we just, don't know what to read. Anytime we don't know what to read from the instruction memory, we're going to send nops down the pipeline. That makes sense? Okay. So that's what I have for today. So after we get back, we'll talk about some better ways of dealing with hazards. So we talked about stalling. Stalling always works, but it's a little unfortunate. So we'll have some better ways of dealing with hazards, which will have us lose less cycles to hazards.